When the historian's ideological bias distorts or ignores evidence from the past, a bad kind of revisionism emerges.
Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, talking about his presentation at the Fall 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
It masquerades as honest history. Such revisionism needs to be exposed and dismantled. It undermines proper understanding of our world. It has been said those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. In this case, failure to expose bad revisionism means that those who do not know the past are condemned to suffer at the hands of biased ideologues who claim they do.
You can meet and hear Dr. Mark Kaltoff making the case against revisionist history at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385.
Let's be frank. A dangerous movement, undetected by many, but real, is now challenging and eroding a great tradition of religious freedom.
These religious leaders would do the world a great deal more good if they would call their people to obedience to those Ten Commandments instead of passing whims of the environmental movement.
I've always said any church that doesn't practice excommunication does not love their people.
Military families in Asia love Issues Etc.
Issues Etc.
An op-ed piece in the New York Times titled "Think the Constitution Will Save Us? Think Again," subtitled "The Subversion of Democracy Was the Explicit Intent of the Framers." It concludes with this phrase. It says, "As long as we think of our Constitution as a sacred document instead of an outdated relic, we will have to deal with its anti-democratic consequences." It makes the case, or attempts to make the case, for elimination of the U.S. Constitution as we know it and the replacement of our current system of government with something else. We'll find out what it is. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, August the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Many are wondering how that made it into the opinion pages of the New York Times, but those are the times we live in now. A little bit later in the program, we'll be playing Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. That's a simple game we like to play with our listeners, where we play four soundbites for you that are taken from this week's Issues Etc. audio. You listen, and after you've listened, you give us a call, 1-877-623-6943. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet, @issuesetc, or go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and you vote for which one will be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Joining us to respond to a recent op-ed in the New York Times titled "Think the Constitution Will Save Us, Think Again," Dr. Russell Dawn, Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much, Todd.
I imagine that since the Constitution itself was being penned, there has never been a time in United States history when the Constitution has been as sharply criticized as in the last several years. Would you agree? And if so, why?
Whether I agree is a more difficult question than why it might be the case. The Constitution was very sharply opposed by the Anti-Federalists at the time it was drafted and before it was adopted, so more than 200 years ago. The progressive era of say, Woodrow Wilson saw a lot of opposition to the Constitution. But to your point about today, there is virulent opposition in some quarters, mainly on the left. And I think the reason for that is that the left thought that the 2016 election was theirs, and specifically the presidential election. And when Hillary Clinton lost, and she lost through the Electoral College, she didn't lose the popular vote, she lost at the Electoral College, which is a feature of the Constitution, then they believed it was such an injustice, and they still believe it was such an injustice, that everything that had to do with Hillary Clinton's loss must be torn down. I really think it is, in a way, a collective tantrum about the loss of the 2016 presidential election.
So rather than come to grips with the fact that Hillary Clinton was, while many people did support and vote for her, that obviously a small majority of the popular vote, as you pointed out, rather than come to grips with the fact that she was essentially a terrible candidate, even the New York Times admits she's a terrible candidate in another op-ed piece, they are saying the system is broken and we got to tear it down.
Yes, that is an admission that many of the rank and file on the left will never make. And to them, the system is, to the extent the system subverts one person, one vote, it is not a just system in their mind.
What is being proposed in the op-ed piece in the New York Times, Think the Constitution Will Save Us, Think Again?
They're proposing a new system of government. Well, they're proposing a gradual redrafting, if you will, reconstituting of the Constitution. They don't want such a, what they call, Byzantine Constitution. The Constitution is complicated, and intentionally so. It creates a complicated government. So that's what checks and balances and separation of powers and federalism are all about, is complicating things to prevent a centralization of power, because a centralization of power can lead to tyranny. So what the authors want is a less complicated system of government, because they believe that the current system creates a government that rules over the people, but rather than the people having self-government, but then it also allows big business to prevent the government from redistributing the wealth of the business to workers. So what they're looking for is a little incoherent, to be honest.
They're calling for this transition, and they say that the main feature of their proposed replacement for our system is a proportionally elected unicameral legislature. To unpack that verbiage for us, if you would.
Yes, I'm not positive what they mean by proportionally, but I'm assuming, based on the ethos of the left, that they're talking about one person, one vote, rather than having an electoral college. And by the term unicameral, they mean get rid of this division between House of Representatives and the Senate. And the legislature, of course, is the Congress, so the legislative side of the government. And their writing isn't as clear as it ought to be, but it appears that's all they want. This is what the government should be, is a proportionally elected one-house, single-house legislature, which is a terrible idea. It violates everything that the founders... Now, of course, the fact that it violates everything the founders wanted is good in their mind, but the founders had a nice, accurate idea of human nature, that human nature cannot allow a concentration of power because people will tend to abuse their power. What these authors want in a unicameral legislature violates that insight and basically says if we can just get popular election of this legislature, then all will be well.
Do they envision doing anything with the executive or judicial branches, or do they envision a government that even includes such things?
As I said, the writing isn't clear. All that they propose is a proportionally elected unicameral legislature. They don't say anything about a judicial branch or an executive branch. And so I can only assume from that they're proposing that the legislature would also act in the executive capacity as well as in the judicial capacity.
It's one thing to talk about changing the nuts and bolts of the U.S. Constitution, because the Constitution really is a complicated document that not only describes how government is structured, it also, in its amendments, and I'm thinking here in particular about the Bill of Rights, it also proscribes what that structure can do vis-a-vis the citizenry. So what are their thoughts in the New York Times appear to be on the Bill of Rights?
They appear to want to keep the Bill of Rights and continue to strengthen it. And by strengthen it, I mean continue to uphold the Bill of Rights. and make sure that we're not impinging on the rights that the Bill of Rights protects. So I would agree with them on that. The problem is they don't understand that the Bill of Rights won't be worth the ink that it took to write it if we don't have a separation of powers to protect it. Many tyrannical nations have bills of rights. The problem is they don't have a separation of powers preventing those who are in power from trampling on their bills of rights.
So this is probably what we need to discuss here in a little more detail. There are two facets to this. One is a system of checks and balances, and the other is a separation of powers. Let's deal with both of those, the second one first. What exactly is the separation of powers as envisioned by the U.S. Constitution?
Yes, the separation of powers entails that laws are made by one branch, the legislative branch. They are enforced by an executive branch, or you could say they are executed. Think of that as carried out. The laws are carried out by the executive branch or the presidency. And then laws are judged, and people are judged according to those laws by a third branch, the judiciary. So the separation of powers is both a practical piece. It separates the functions so that people are not having to do everything. They can do their bit. But it's also part of our fundamental protection that those who enact the laws are not the ones who are executing the laws and are also not the ones judging the laws.
Now, checks and balances, which is a little more informal and a little more complicated, it kind of comes about in the sense of limiting, as the three powers kind of do their part, they are able to get in each other's way a little bit for the good of the people.
Yes, that's a great way of putting it. And I couldn't agree more with your last comment there, for the good of the people. We need these powerful forces to be able to get in one another's way so that there isn't a single one of them that can overwhelm us, the people. So how does this happen? Well, the legislative branch can't make a law without getting the president to sign it, unless, and this is another form of checks and balances, unless they can override a presidential veto. So the president has power to stop the legislative branch, but the legislative branch can override, if you will, the president's stoppage. So the president doesn't have ultimate power in legislation either. Likewise, the judicial branch can declare laws to be unconstitutional, to be contrary to the Constitution that all three branches are sworn to uphold. But at the same time, the judicial branch has no sword and no purse. The power of the purse is in the legislative branch, and the power of the sword is in the executive branch. So those two branches have some power vis-a-vis the judicial branch. The judiciary, at least in its original conception, would not have ultimate power. It is subject, at least at the margins, to control by the legislative and executive.
We are responding to a recent op-ed in the New York Times titled, Think the Constitution Will Save Us, Think Again. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest, director of the pre-law program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. On the subject of the U.S. Constitution, Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation will be making the case for our first freedoms at the Fall 2018 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference. He'll be joined by Anthony Esselin, Mark Kaltoff, Beverly Yonke, Chris Rosebro, and Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Early bird registration for the conference before September 1st is $110. That includes three meals. Thanks to Wittenberg Academy, childcare is free. You can register by check. Send it along with a downloadable registration form at issuesetc.org to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also register online at our website. Making the Case is Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. When we come back, does the New York Times op-ed have anything to say about, well, the states, who all have their own constitutions and their own governments? We'll be right back.
Western civilization, infant baptism, transgenderism, a legal case for the resurrection, the First Amendment, revisionist history. Your favorite guests will address these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Dallas Page, Fort Worth
Nights. I've written a column in the latest Issues Etc. journal titled Confessions of a Well-Intentioned Preacher. It details how I mistakenly ignored or explained away entire parts of Scripture in order to protect my hearers from legalism. We'll send it to you for free. Just click the red journal subscription button in the right-hand column at issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Lyman Stone writes about the certainty he found in the presence of Christ in his word and sacraments. The free online Issues Etc. journal.
Recently graduated from high school or college and looking for a chance to serve a community in need while sharing the good news of Jesus Christ? Lutheran Young Adult Corps may be for you. Lutheran Young Adult Corps provides opportunities for long-term, full-time service for 10 weeks through the summer or 10 months over the school year in places like St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Boston. Find out more about Lutheran Young Adult Corps by finding us online at lcms.org/YACORPS or on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Lutheran YA Corps.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. returned to the air on June 30th after being canceled by the previous leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod during Holy Week of 2008. For a special 10-year anniversary donation of $100 or more, we'll send you a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. You can make an anniversary gift online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
You've literally got goats who are being told that they are sheep because they've never been brought to penance and faith in Christ.
Islam goes on the conquest, ransacks, destroys the old post-Roman Christian world. Okay, it gets less than 30 pages, and in those pages, you're not going to come across the word invasion or conquest.
As soon as we stop addressing sin and guilt and death, as soon as we stop addressing the sacredness of life, we lose our birthright as Christians, and we may be relevant to the moment, but we are certainly irrelevant to God's purpose and plan.
On the divine side, we go, look at those whom Christ has crowned with the stars of martyrdom, one after the other. He has called them and crowned them, and it is a blessed thing.
Just a taste of the 4 sound bites that we're going to play for you in their entirety when we play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week in the last half hour of the program. We'll play those sound bites for you. You will vote, and then your votes will determine which will be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. In the meantime, we're responding to an op-ed in the New York Times titled Think the Constitution Will Save Us. Think again. Dr. Russell Dawn is our guest. He's Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University in Irvine, California. Dr. Dawn, does the New York op-ed piece have anything to say about the states themselves, about their constitutions and their forms of government?
Yes, the impact would be enormous. They want a more powerful central government, but they don't address what this would mean for the states, at least not much. One thing they do say is that they would give the vote to citizens in territories like Puerto Rico and in the District of Columbia. But they don't say anything about the effect of this on the states, which is a little bit surprising in this day and age, because states' rights is something that each political party tends to rediscover when it is out of power at the federal level. So right now, the Democrats are out of power at the federal level, and so there are a lot of people rediscovering the importance of states' rights. A lot of people on the left rediscovering that importance. one example of this, a prominent example of this, is the passage of marijuana laws, the decriminalization of marijuana in various jurisdictions, including my own California. Well, marijuana is still illegal at the federal level, but the states' rights folks on the left are now saying, well, we need to keep the federal government out of our business here when it comes to marijuana. So the fact that these authors are ignoring states and states' rights completely is a little tone deaf to even their own movement.
Okay, let's see if maybe they just fail to understand something as fundamental as democracy. When I hear a description of what they're calling for, the thing they do call for, which is this directly elected or proportionally elected unicameral legislature, and I hear crickets on the other branches of government, and I hear very little said about the impact on state governments and state constitutions, it sounds to me like they're simply saying, let's just get as close as we can to direct democracy. Why is that a terrible idea, and why did the founders understand instinctually that it was a terrible idea?
Yes, that is what they're looking for, is something, as you say, as close to direct democracy as a nation of 300 plus million people can get. And it's a terrible idea because tyranny can come from the populace, just like tyranny can come from a monarch or from aristocrats. So the history of political thought is filled with examinations of how a society can be governed. It can be governed by one, a monarchy. It can be governed by a few, an aristocracy. Or it can be governed by many, a democracy. Well, the problem with each of these isn't in the number of people. The problem is that when any of those forms of government is run by people who are feeding on the people rather than serving them, who is running the country or running the society for their own benefit rather than for the benefit of the people they govern, well, that's tyrannical. That can happen in a monarchy, it can happen in an aristocracy, and it can happen in a democracy. And many in the history of political thought have thought that the mob rule, democratic rule without any sort of control, without any sort of protection for the minority, is the worst possible form. It's the worst possible form of tyranny because it's the most difficult to eradicate because you have the majority of the people behind it. So really, if we have a direct democracy here, there is nothing preventing the majority from oppressing the minority and excusing it with the claim, well, this is the will of the people. It's a terrible idea. It's exactly what the founders wanted to prevent, as well as preventing a monarchical tyranny.
The response of the framers was eventually more or less a federalism. That was their response to all of the debate that surrounded the Constitution, its original writing. What is federalism, and why does it, while not perfect, why does it do a better job than anything else we've discovered so far of preventing tyranny?
The federal form of government that they created, this, well, a couple of ways of thinking about it. They formed a Republican government, small r Republican, not the political party, which is to say representative democracy. But it's a representative democracy that involves these checks and balances, these checks even on the power of people, of the people in electing. And that's what the Electoral College does, is it acts as a check on the power of the mob, the majority. And then federalism is the distinction between the central government, the national government, if you will, and the governments of the various states. In the historical context of the American founding, the colonies were independent of one another. And when the United States of America was formed, the states were viewed as, roughly speaking, independent of one another, dependent only through this federal or agreement type of government. That's what the word federal means. It's government by agreement. So it's really that these various states are agreeing to a limited central government. And all of the rest of the functions that will be carried out by government, all of the functions not delegated to the central government, are to be carried out by the individual states independent of one another. And that federalism, that division of power, not only among the three branches of the central government, but between the central government and the various states, has led to, well, again, it diminishes the power of the central government over the individual, and it diminishes the power of the state government, because the federal government, the highest law in the land, the federal law is the highest law in the land. So states are limited too, and this leads to freedom and, if you will, experiments in freedom. Different states treat freedom differently. Some are more expansive, some are less expansive. And as those experiments move forward through the history of the United States, states have succeeded partially on the basis of the extent to which they have embraced ordered liberty.
To kind of simplify it, I think I heard one historian say that at the founding of the Constitution, they would have referred to the United States as the same way we talk about the media. It's a plural noun. And now we routinely talk about the United States as a singular noun. That's not just a shift in kind of sloppy grammar. It's also perhaps a shift in the way we think about the United States. What do you think?
It is, absolutely. They, at the time of the founding, they referred to the United States with the verb are. The United States are doing this. And they also could refer to these United States. So a bunch of states that are united through this federal constitution. That changed most dramatically in the wake of the Civil War. Really, the Civil War and the amendments to the Constitution that followed the Civil War were enormous game changers in the history of how we view states and states' rights versus how we view the central government. It really was the victory of the central government over state sovereignty. Now, in the context of the Civil War, with the depredations of slavery and the horrible oppression of that, it was a deserved victory by the central government. The states were abusing their power. The southern states were abusing their power by abusing the African people in their midst. And the central government needed to come together to hold the Union together and to stop that oppression.
Do you think that perhaps the major flaw of the op-ed piece in the New York Times and what it proposes is ignorance of the history of the U.S. Constitution, ignorance of the history of how we elect presidents? I mean, they would be appalled to learn how we used to elect presidents.
yes.
It would seem far less democratic to them. Do you think that's the major flaw here?
Yes, I think ignorance of history and also just muddied thought. They complain about having a central government that's too strong, and yet they also complain about a central government that isn't strong enough. I just think their own thoughts are unclear. So it was almost just a thoughtless vent that somehow made it into the New York Times opinion page. So I would encourage them to study history, and I would encourage them to think carefully and in detail and require much of themselves, require evidence for their assertions. And once they require that of themselves, then they'll be able to articulate something better. The Constitution is imperfect, and we can move forward on amending it as we have need. But any movement forward should be very thoughtful and very cautious and very informed, not this sort of screed that really accomplishes nothing.
In that vein, and with about 30 seconds here, Dr. Don, I just like your simple response to the way that the op-ed piece concludes. It says, as long as we think of our Constitution as a sacred document instead of an outdated relic, we will have to deal with its anti-democratic consequences. What's your simple response to that with about 30 seconds?
Well, it isn't an outdated relic. It isn't outdated because it has a right understanding of human nature. Human beings are fallen, and we will tend to abuse whatever power we have. The Constitution took that into account in brilliant ways, and therefore it will never be an outdated relic. If they think it is an outdated relic, well, it isn't. The Bill of Rights is not many years newer. They don't seem to think of that as an outdated relic, so perhaps they should take a more holistic and humble view of things.
Dr. Russell Dawn is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought and Director of the Pre-Law Program at Concordia University, Irvine, California. He holds a Juris Doctor degree from the University of Colorado, and he's a contributor to The Federalist. Dr. Dawn, thanks for being our guest, and we're really looking forward to you leading us in a series this fall on the U.S. Constitution. Thank you.
Always a pleasure, Todd. I look forward to it as well.
When we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time with you, our listeners. We like to play a game with our listeners at the end of our broadcast week. And since it's Friday and we're coming to you live, we're going to play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. What we've done is gone back through the last week of Issues Etc. audio, and we've found four soundbites. We're going to play them for you on the other side of the break. And after you have heard them, that's where your part begins. You give us a call. 1-877-623-MY-IE, 1-877-623-6943, or you send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org. We get that right here in the studio in real time, talkback@issuesetc.org. Send us a tweet at issuesetc, or you can go to our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc, and we've left space there for you to vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We'll play the four soundbites. Then we need to hear from you. Your votes count, and your votes will decide which will be Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. We're also giving away the LPR bundle package. That's an I Have Issues t-shirt, an Issues Etc. travel mug, pen, bumper sticker, and notepad, and it goes to the listener with the best vote for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
When you pray, give us this day our daily bread. What do you mean by daily bread? What do you really need to live? If you've ever puzzled over questions like these, you won't want to miss the August issue of The Lutheran Witness. With articles on downsizing, giving, and yes, what we mean by our daily bread, you're sure to come away with a more biblical view of wealth and poverty, possessions and generosity. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. During August, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their Ministry of the Month, Lutheran Education Association. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU. Good for you, good for the church. LutheranFCU.org.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, "A Changeless Christ for a Changing World." While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in His church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
An average of 20 military veterans kill themselves every day. Project Operation Barnabas is a network of LCMS congregations who reach out to veterans and their congregations and their communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces. Serving those who serve. LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. lcms.org/armedforces.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Come and experience firsthand by sitting down in classes and actually hearing professors, coming to chapel, which is always the high point of the day, to hear the Word of God and to lift our voices in song.
Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Paul Grimm on why you should consider visiting Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Spend time talking to professors. I mean, there's not a professor here who will not be willing to take time, whether it's after chapel during the coffee hour or just to come into one study and sit down and talk for a while, to answer questions, to, you know, help them to get a sense of, A, you know, do they want to be a pastor or a deaconess? And then B, is this the right place? And, well, maybe C would be the question, is now the right time for them to make that decision?
If you've contemplated the vocation of pastor or deaconess, contact Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155, 800-481-2155, or send an email to admission@ctsfw.edu.